This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, one of the reasons that we don't pay a lot of attention to lead anymore, we used to, and we don't anymore because a lot of people think we've pretty much solved the problem. The frustration here is, you know, we think the lead is all gone, but it's not.
The policy decisions we make today will have an impact on the next 100 years and beyond. It kind of makes you think, what policy decisions from the last century are we dealing with today? This week on Sea Change Radio, we focus on lead, a heavy metal whose regulation was slow to follow the discovery that it was highly toxic. The lag time meant the widespread use of this hazardous element as an ingredient in everyday substances like gasoline and house paint, and a hazardous legacy that is still being felt. First, I speak to Mother Jones political writer Kevin Drum, who's recently published a set of high-profile articles suggesting a link between lead levels in our environment and crime rates. Then, we welcome my sister, Sarah Hess, who shares her personal story of lead exposure and how it inspired her to become a community advocate for safe and lead-free playgrounds. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kevin Drum. He's a writer for Mother Jones. Kevin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here.
You wrote a multi-part piece on lead for Mother Jones recently. The lead story was America's real criminal element, lead. What drew you to the piece, and maybe you can give us a recap of your basic thesis?
We've known for a long time, for many decades, that that lead has serious effects when children are exposed to it. It lowers their IQ. They get more learning disabilities. They do worse in school and things like that. That's been known for a long time. But over the last decade or so, there's been a whole new body of research that suggests lead also affects parts of the brain, parts of the prefrontal cortex that are that involve things like impulse control, things like judgment, emotional regulation, and aggression. In other words, children who are exposed to lead don't just have their IQs lower, they actually become more aggressive when they grow up than they otherwise would be. And so, you know, some people sort of took a look at that and started wondering if that might explain the reason that crime increased really dramatically in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, America went through a huge crime wave. Crime more than doubled over that period. And then, in a complete surprise, something that nobody predicted and nobody expected, starting in the early 90s, suddenly crime plummeted. And for the last 20 years, crime has just gone down, down, down. In New York, for example, violent crime rates today are about one-fourth of what they were in 1991. So there's been a huge increase in crime, then a huge decrease in crime, and people started looking at whether or not that might be because of lead.
And people think of lead as lead paint generally, but the real poisoning of America from lead came from gasoline, right?
That's right. The basic story here is that after World War II, we all started buying cars, lots and lots of cars, and we filled those cars up with leaded gasoline. And all that lead came spewing out of our tailpipes, went into the atmosphere, settled down into the soil and into the air where children ingested it. And so lead levels in the bloodstream of children, especially in big cities where there's a lot of cars, increased. Now, you have to wait for those children to grow up. So these are children who were born in the late 40s and 50s. You wait for them to grow up, and in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, when they're 18, 20, 30 years old, it turns out that, yeah, they were committing many more violent crimes than in the past. And the crime rate in America went way up. Now, the second half of this story is that in 1975, the EPA started to ban lead slowly but surely. In 1975, they took the first step. In 1985, they took the second step. By 1995, lead was totally banned in gasoline. So now you take a look at children who were born around the middle 70s, and you wait for them to grow up, and by the early 90s, you have a generation of children who weren't exposed to lead and weren't sort of made artificially more violent. And it turns out those children committed fewer crimes. And so starting in the early 90s, the crime rate went down, down, down. And it's all because of less gasoline lead spewing out into the atmosphere.
Well, you make the point in your piece that there are lots of factors that go into it, and that this is kind of one of the hidden elements that hasn't really been examined. But it's a pretty complex analysis to try to understand a whole nation's violent crime rise. Can you tell us a little bit more about the studies that linked aggression and lead?
Yeah, and I should make clear something here, that nobody is suggesting that lead is the only source of violence and aggression. It's not the only source of crime. In fact, one way to think about it is you can sort of think of kind of a baseline level of crime. And that baseline level is going to have a lot of factors. There are going to be issues of culture, issues of race, issues of poverty, issues of guns and drugs, the economy, policing tactics. Mm-hmm. All of those things sort of contribute to the baseline level of crime. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We've got a baseline level of crime, and it might go up and down a bit over time based on all those factors we just mentioned. But in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we weren't at a baseline level. We saw this enormous increase that was really hard to explain, and then an enormous decrease that was really hard to explain until today, when we're sort of back down to that baseline level, close to it anyway. And so we're trying to explain not all crime. We're trying to explain why we saw, just for this period of 30 or 40 years, this sudden rise and sudden fall. Now, there's several different studies that suggest lead is the real culprit in that. First, you have what are called econometric studies or population studies. Okay, you take a look at an entire population, and you look at lead levels, say, in the entire country, and then you take a look at crime rates in the entire country, and you see if they match. Well, it turns out they do. They match really, really well. So then you go a step further. You can do a study that looks at different states. And you can take a look. Some states banned lead faster than other states. And you would expect, hey, if they got rid of lead faster, their crime rates would go down faster. It turns out that's exactly what happened. You can take a look at the city level. You'll see the same thing. You can even take a look at this in different countries. Different countries around the world banned lead at different times. And it turns out that in these countries, their crime rates also went up and went down, but they went up and down at different times, and it always matches when they, you know, the period when they started to ban lead in gasoline. Okay, so that's one thread. These population studies is sort of one thread of evidence. Now, there's a second thread, which is what's called a longitudinal study. One of the most famous ones has been done at the University of Cincinnati for the last 30 plus years. They started a study in 1981, and they took newborn children. They took about 400 newborn children, picked randomly, and every 6 months they measured the lead levels in their blood. And then they tracked a whole bunch of other things about these children as well. And what they found was, as the children grew up, you know, at age 5, they were doing worse in school. At age 15, they were involved in more juvenile delinquency. At age 25, their arrest rates for violent crimes were higher. I mean, it popped right out of the data. The more lead they had in their blood, the worse they were doing. Now, it took a long time to make the connection to violent crime because you've got to wait for them to grow up. So it wasn't until around 2000, 2005 that the researchers really started to make a serious connection in that study to violent crime. So that's a second thread, these longitudinal studies. Third thread is, take some of these kids that we knew had high blood lead levels when they were children, and now they're grown up, of course, and you can put them in MRI machines and take a look directly at their brains. And at the University of Cincinnati, they've done exactly that. They've taken some of the subjects of their study, they put them in MRI machines, and they've done a whole bunch of different looks at their brains, and they found that, sure enough, the subjects that had high blood lead levels when they were children show degradation in areas of the brain, in both gray matter and white matter areas of the brain, that affect, as I said earlier, things like impulse control, aggression, judgment, emotional regulation, and so forth. All the things that you would exactly expect to contribute to violent crime. I mean, if you have trouble with impulse control, you're going to be more likely to commit violent crimes. Now, you put all three of those things together, and you have really a very strong body of evidence that these lead emissions from gasoline were very closely associated with the rise and then the fall of violent crime, not just in America, but around the entire world.
See my friends coming, riding many a mile. Friends, you get some silver, you get a little gold. What did you bring me, my dear friends? Keep me from the gallows pole. What did you bring me? Keep me from the gallows pole. Silver, I couldn't get no gold. You know the way too damn poor.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mother Jones writer Kevin Drum. Let's take a step back and give us a brief history of why lead was in gasoline in the first place and why that's different than lead in paint in terms of how it affected us.
You know, when you see unleaded gasoline, your first thought might be that, hey, they're actually taking the lead out of gasoline, that maybe lead is in gasoline naturally and you've got to remove it.
Yeah, that's what I, as a little kid, I remember thinking that exact thing.
Right, and that's, of course, that it turns out that's exactly the opposite of what happened. So the history of lead as an additive, it's an additive to gasoline, is that in the 1920s, car engines of the time had a lot of ping, a lot of knock. They didn't run very well on gasoline of the time. And so engineers at GM were looking for ways to increase the octane level of gasoline. Well, they tried a whole bunch of different things, and eventually they settled on this additive called tetraethyl lead, TEL. And it was invented at GM and patented by GM, and eventually kind of hived off into a separate corporation called the Ethyl Corporation. If you remember back in the old days, you might remember your father, going into a gas station and saying, fill her up with ethyl. And what that meant was fill it up with gasoline that had ethyl added to it. And ethyl is lead.
So that was the good stuff.
Right, exactly. That was high test. That was premium gasoline, was the stuff with lead in it. It made your major engine run better. It was higher octane. So we deliberately added ethyl to gasoline as a way of making engines run better. Now, you know, the truth is, we knew at the time, GM knew at the time, their engineers knew at the time, they knew that tetraethyl lead was poisonous stuff. DuPont actually owned a big chunk of GM back at the time, so they were very close. And although GM developed the tetraethyl lead additive, they initially contracted with DuPont to manufacture it. So DuPont was pretty closely involved in the whole thing.
And they were well aware that TEL was not just a great little way to make your car not knock. It was much more to that. It was pretty obvious, right?
As a matter of fact, I mean, ironically, the guy who invented tetraethyl lead, a guy named Thomas Midgley, spent a couple of years in the lab working with it, insisting that it was perfectly safe. But after a couple of years of working with it, he actually had to take a year off to recover because he was suffering from lead poisoning. And at very high exposures, it affects adults. At smaller levels, it's mostly an issue of children at smaller levels. And sort of at the levels that you see today, it's almost exclusively today, in America anyway, it's almost exclusively a problem of exposure to small children where it does permanent damage to the development of their brain.
But there was something else that worked in your piece. You mentioned how ethanol actually would have taken out the knocks from cars just as easily as TEL, but there were several reasons why ethanol was not added. Can you explain?
Right. I mean, ironically, and I say ironically because, of course, today I'm an opponent of ethanol. I think ethanol is a big boondoggle. But back in the 1920s, GM knew there was an additive already that would make engines work great, and it was ethyl alcohol, which is ethanol, which you can make from corn. And if you made fuel out of, you know, roughly 80% gasoline and 20% ethanol, it ran great. And in fact, back in the 1920s in Britain, they sold that stuff. That's how they sold gasoline back in Britain in the 1920s, was this combination of gasoline and ethanol, because it ran really well. But, you know, from GM's point of view, it wasn't a great solution, partly because, you know, it requires a lot of ethanol. So you've got to convince the oil folks to put a lot of ethanol in their fuel. The oil folks didn't like it because, you know, 20% more ethanol means 20% less gasoline, and they're in the business of selling gasoline. And then third, you can't patent it. You can't make any money off this. When GM invented tetraethyl lead as an additive, they patented it. And they made a lot of money on tetraethyl lead over the years. And, you know, from their standpoint, anything you can patent is better than anything you can't.
Let me add a fourth theory there. We had a guest on Sea Change Radio last year, Josh Tickell, the filmmaker who's made a couple pro-ethanol films. This one is called Freedom. And in the movie, he postulates that the oil companies worked with the government to try to make ethanol classified as alcohol so that it would be folded into the prohibition issue so that people would start being afraid of people craving liquor at the gas station and just pouring the ethanol right into their moonshine jugs and taking off, which it's a leap, I admit, but it's worth adding to the list of theories.
There's no question that the oil companies were opposed to it, and certainly they were willing to use pretty much any argument to fight it. But the reason they were opposed was because they're in the business of selling oil. One of the frustrations about this is that you know, one of the reasons that we don't pay a lot of attention to lead anymore, and we used to, and we don't anymore because a lot of people think we've pretty much solved the problem, right? I mean, lead paint was banned in 1978. Leaded gasoline was completely banned at the end of 1995. The frustration here is, you know, we think the lead is all gone, but it's not, because we spent five decades spewing leaded gasoline into the atmosphere, and it all has to go somewhere, right? And where it went was it settled into the soil, and it's still there.
You propose in your article some pretty compelling ways to fight crime and to tackle this issue more than just taking out lead from our gas.
Again, I want to emphasize that if you want to fight crime, there's a lot of different ways of doing it.
But for decades, we've been fighting this war on drugs, and we've been locking up people at insane rates. And while crime has gone down, the links are specious at best.
Well, right. You know, people look at incarceration. You know, we doubled the prison population in the 80s, and then we doubled it again. And, you know, a lot of people have drawn the conclusion that crime is down because we put a lot of people behind bars. Now, there's something to that. Just from the simple fact that once you've got violent people who are committing crimes, if you put them in prison, they're not going to commit more crimes. But the causation there might very well be backwards. It's not that putting people in prison reduced crime. It's the fact that lead was causing more crime in the first place, and therefore you've got more people to put in prison. But, you know, going forward from today, as we see crime rates plummet, and we see crime rates especially plummeting among the younger people, among, you know, 17, 18, 20-year-olds who have grown up in completely lead-free environments. As we see those crime rates plummet, with a time lag, you're going to see prison populations go down too. I wouldn't be at all surprised if 10 years from now, we're starting to shut down prisons because there just flatly isn't enough crime to populate the prisons that we spent all that money building in the 80s and 90s.
Because of the lead bubble, you think?
Exactly, because we built them, I think, largely because of the lead bubble, as you put it. So, you know, what we're asking politicians to do is hard. We're asking them to spend a lot of money on two things. One would be cleaning up soil with lead in it, and the other would be cleaning up all the remaining lead paint. Now, you know, that costs a lot of money. And what you're asking them to do is to spend a lot of money on something that's going to reduce crime 20 years from now when they're not in office anymore. So it's a tough ask, but that's what we need to be doing. We need to clean up the soil. We need to clean up the lead paint. We need to finish the job. We've done a lot of it. We need to finish it up. We need to clean up the last of the lead in our environment. And the benefit of doing that would almost certainly far, far outweigh the cost. I mean, it's when I say it costs a lot of money, my kind of best guess is that it might cost $10 or $20 billion a year. Now, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a lot. But the benefits could easily be well over $100 billion a year in, you know, better adjusted children, smarter children, higher lifetime earnings, less crime.
Mother Jones writer Kevin Drumm, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
Now we welcome to Sea Change Radio a very special guest, my sister, Sarah Hess. Sarah, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hello, Alex.
We had Kevin Drumm on the show earlier who wrote about how lead has affected soil, and there's some relation he postulates between lead levels in our population and crime levels. But there's another type of lead poisoning that's affected a lot of people, and that's not from gasoline through the decades, but from lead paint. And that affected you and your family personally. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened?
Well, we first discovered that our eldest child, Josephine, Josie we call her, went for her one-year checkup. And in New Orleans, because we have high lead levels here, it is required that one-year-olds have a lead test. And my doctor's office has all the equipment in-house, so it was a very quick finger prick test, which has a high error ratio. You have to get a vein test, but they start with a finger prick to determine whether or not you need to progress to a vein test. And they tested her and 10 minutes later came back and said she was at an 8. Now, anything under 10 at the time was not required to be reported to the CDC. However, that level has dropped to 5. And every doctor that I've talked to tells me that anything over 2.5 shows an acute exposure.
And what does lead actually do to a child's brain and body? Why is it so harmful?
The thing that happens with lead is that it's treated like calcium. If the body gets it in its system, it treats lead molecules exactly like it would treat calcium molecules. It gets confused. Calcium is, of course, in the bones, and it's also in the brain synapses. So it affects neuron development, and it also affects bone development. So you have, instead of the calcium molecule, you would have a lead molecule where the calcium molecule belongs. And it creates bad connections in the brain. And can also relate to soft bone tissue, because lead is a very soft thing, whereas calcium is very hard. So that's a problem also. The brain does not do well with lead in its system, and it leads to sort of these invisible changes. By the time Josie was about to turn 2, and we were going in, and they were saying, "Are you having any behavioral problems?" And I'm like, "Well, she's 2, so you know, yeah." But the question was, are the behavioral problems lead related or are they just, you know, regular development? So it's this really scary time of, you know, every time she threw a fit, as 2-year-olds sometimes do, you are looking at her thinking, is this my child riddled with lead or is this just normal?
So you thought you had isolated the problem to be with your home, but that turned out to not be the only problem. What happened next?
So while we're sanding the house, we moved into a neighborhood, an old neighborhood that had a playground. And everybody had been telling me that you have to, it's in your house. It's in your house. You need to clean your house. It's that your house isn't clean enough. And your house has lead paint because you don't mop enough. Because we keep our we had kept our shoes on when we walked around into the house, that these were the major culprits. So we would go, we were using all of those tactics in this new residence that we were staying in, but we were going to a playground where Josie was playing that I found out later had huge amounts of lead in it. And nobody had said anything about playgrounds. Nobody had said, don't let her eat at playgrounds, wash hands after playgrounds, don't let her put her mouth in her hands in her mouth when she's at playgrounds. None of that had come up. And I've talked to doctors, the city's lead poisoning prevention program, talked to a lot of people, nurses. Nobody said anything about playgrounds.
This was not just a unique playground. This is more of an epidemic among playgrounds in New Orleans, or is this...
Any playground in a residential neighborhood near old houses is bound to have lead dirt because people sand their houses and they don't think about that playground. So even though all the equipment has been changed and the equipment isn't lead positive, it has lead dust on it from people sanding their houses and also from the old dirt on the streets can still have lead from the gasoline, from the old gasoline. That is possible.
And how long did it take to get Josie's lead levels back to normal?
2 more years.
And how did you go about that besides the playground and the house?
Green vegetables. Lots of green vegetables. Seaweed became like the go-to snack. Cilantro has an amazing healing power. We also gave her, I think it's called diaphanous earth. It's a powder that you can, it's like clean dirt that you put in her juice, and that was supposed to help. I mean, everything that we could come up with, we did, and we did get those lead levels down really fast. 2 years is actually a good amount of time.
So you don't necessarily know if you're out of the woods with your daughter, Josie, or my niece, and even though her levels are back down, how would they manifest themselves later?
High lead levels can affect reading comprehension and also the development of the empathy part of your brain. And it's really difficult to instill in your child a level of empathy if they don't have it.
You could also see how that would manifest itself as an adult with crime levels, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you have a child, if you're not able to feel how somebody else is feeling, then you might hurt them and you might not look after them. We are responsible community members because we think about how other people feel. When we were in the peak of our lead exposure and Josie starts throwing fits and you end up, you're looking at her on the floor throwing a fit and you're thinking, is this because she's turning two or is this because she has lead in her body? It is this really gray area. I have friends who have, you know, who have children with developmental issues and they put it down to the lead. And, you know, I'm a lead advocate and I question it. And I have people who think that it's not the lead, and I look at their kids and think, well, maybe you should get your kid tested. It's really difficult. It's very much a gray area. And I think that what Kevin Drum offered in the Mother Jones article with looking at the statistics of on a national level and also country to country, that the lead levels and the crime levels overlapped is much more effective than looking family to family. I think there's too many variables to say whether my daughter or your kid's exposure, but when we look at crime as a whole and we look at lead as a whole and we see those overlays, that's where I start getting convinced.
My sister, Sarah Hess, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Brother Alex. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stevie Ray Vaughan, Led Zeppelin, and Eric Clapton. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.